Chapter 23. Families of Death. One of the most bizarre cases in criminal history is also the earliest British murder case of which there is a detailed record. And the details are so incredible that they sound like the plot of a horror film. Anyone who knows the Highlands of Scotland realises that there is something frightening about those great tracts of bleak hillside and boggy valleys. A touch of the emptiness of the Sahara Desert. In the year 1400, the whole of Scotland was like this, from John O'Groats to the border. Glasgow means dark glen, and it was little more than that. Even the city of Edinburgh, later the seat of the royal family, was hardly larger than a modern country town. It was in the reign of James I of Scotland that the people of Galloway were subjected to a reign of terror. Travellers were vanishing, so many of them that the natives at first suspected a pack of wolves. But there were no wolves. In that bleak country they would have starved to death. And even wolves would have left behind some sign of their presence, blood-stained clothing or the bones of a horse. There were no such signs. The travellers had simply vanished. Alarmed by the situation, the king sent his officers to investigate the natives. Several suspicious-looking tramps were arrested and hanged just to be on the safe side. A number of innkeepers fell under suspicion and were also executed. But the vanishings went on. They continued for so many years that some people reached the conclusion that there were supernatural forces at work, werewolves or perhaps the devil himself. One day, a man and his wife were returning from a village fair, both riding on the same horse. Suddenly, a wild-looking man leapt out of the bushes at the side of the road and seized the horse's bridle. There was a yell, and suddenly the horse seemed to be surrounded by savages. The man drew his cutlass and slashed at them, spurring his steed. His wife screamed as she was pulled off from behind. One of the creatures slashed at her throat with a knife. The man was dragged to the ground, and at that moment, rescue belatedly arrived. A crowd of about 30 people returning from the same fair came round the corner. What they saw stunned them. The woman's clothes had been torn off and someone had disemboweled her. Others were tearing at her flesh and apparently eating it. It was like watching a pack of hunting dogs tearing a deer to pieces. The husband was still holding off other attackers with his cutlass. Someone gave a shout. Within seconds, the cannibals had vanished at incredible speed. The woman was dead, but her husband and the horse were alive, the first living creatures to survive an attack from the human wolves in 25 years. It now became clear why travellers had vanished without trace. The wife's body had already been dragged a considerable distance off the road. If any traveller had passed by the spot 24 hours later, he would have noticed nothing, for by that time the bloodstains would have been indistinguishable from the brown grass and heather. The news was immediately carried to the king in Edinburgh. Within 4 days, he was in Galloway with a troop of 400 men. They went to the place on the road where the woman had been killed. There were plenty of rocks and thickets where the murderers could have hidden to waylay travellers. They then set out across the moorland in the direction taken by the fleeing murderers. In a short time, they arrived at the seashore. The scene was dominated by tall cliffs, and below them the sea pounded on the rocks. They waited until the tide went out, and then rowed along the beach, looking for any sign of habitation. There seemed to be nothing. They noticed some caves, but none of them big enough to shelter a large gang. Discouraged, they turned and went back. At this moment, however, two of the hunting dogs began barking at a small crack in the cliff face. Someone clambered up to examine it. It hardly seemed wide enough to admit a human being, but the dogs had now gone inside and were still barking and howling with excitement as if they had sighted their quarry. The king sent some men to the nearest village for torches, while a few of his soldiers ventured into the rocky cleft and called out that it seemed to go deep into the cliff. Finally, the torches arrived. Led by the almost hysterical dogs, the men squeezed through the crack and followed the winding, narrow way. A sickening smell came from inside. Quite suddenly, the tunnel opened out into a cave. In its recesses, they could see crouching human figures, dazzled by the torchlight. In the corners, there were piles of money and jewels, and hanging from the ceiling, objects that were easily recognisable as parts of human beings. Arms, legs, torsos. Cornered in their den, the wild creatures were prepared to fight, but they were quickly overcome by the men in armour. The soldiers counted their prisoners and discovered that a family of 48 beings was crowded into the cave. It became clear why the cave dwellers had flung themselves on the murdered woman with such ravenous appetite. They were cannibals, and the unappetizing lumps of flesh were part of their larder. They ate it raw. It must have seemed a luxury for them to be able to eat fresh meat. The soldiers buried the limbs and torsos in the sand. The savages were taken to the Tolbooth in Edinburgh, which is still standing, and then to Leith. By this time it had been established that the head of the family was a man named Sawney Bean, who had been born in East Lothian, not far from Edinburgh. As a youth he had run away with a woman, and for 25 years they had been living in the same cave. The woman had been fertile, giving him 8 sons and 6 daughters. These, in turn, had produced 18 grandsons and 14 granddaughters. Leith was their place of execution. There was no trial, it being thought needless to try creatures who were even professed enemies to mankind, recorded the chronicler John Nicholson of Kirkcudbright. The barbarity with which the beans were executed was typical of the period. The men's hands and feet were chopped off, and they were left to bleed to death. The women folk, having been made to watch this, were then burned alive in 3 fires. They all in general died without the least sign of repentance, wrote Nicholson, but continued cursing and vending the most dreadful imprecations to the very last gasp of life. In executing them without trial, the king recognised that they were wild beasts. It's a pity he could not have ordered them to be killed as cleanly as such. Civilised culture is only skin deep, and there are well-authenticated cases of human babies who've been brought up by wild animals. There have been several such instances recorded in India. In one of the most remarkable, a wolf child was captured by hunters at the age of 2 and taken back to civilization. Like Kipling's Mowgli, he had been brought up by wolves since babyhood. Presumably his parents were killed by them, and the baby acquired the smell of the animals, which would be enough to protect him. But the child remained a wolf for the rest of his short life. No amount of civilized training could make him behave like a human being. There is a central lesson to be learned from the Sawney Bean family. It applies to all murderous families, which explains why they're so rare in the history of crime. When people reach the extremes of desperation, they turn away from human society, and in so doing, they place a gap between themselves and the rest of humanity. They look upon other human beings as a farmer looks upon his sheep and pigs, as a different species. It makes no difference whether they do this instinctively, as the Beans did, or intellectually, as Charles Manson's followers did. In a fundamental sense, they cease to be human. It's shocking to read about Sawney Bean's family disemboweling a woman and eating her flesh in front of her husband, but it's no worse than what Manson's followers did to the actress Sharon Tate and to the LaBiancas. It is definitely not sadism, any more than the Jewish butcher is sadistic when he cuts the throat of a kosher animal and drains off its blood. It's basically the attitude of one carnivorous species to another. The same is true of the homicidal Bender family of Kansas, who in the 1870s murdered travellers who ate at their hostel. They were not murderers, so much as butchers. There is a paradox in the idea of a family banding together to commit murder. Members of a family feel close to one another. They are aware of one another as human beings. In that case, they're found to be aware of their neighbours as human beings. Unless they feel desperate, fighting with their backs to the wall against the rest of society, they're unlikely to combine together for purposes of slaughter. Families like the Beans, the Benders, the Mansons, are million-to-one chance accidents. In almost every case, the reasons for the accident are completely different. But they can be roughly classified into 3 groups. Sadism, gain, and resentment. Apart from the Beans, British criminal history has 2 cases of murderous families which fall into the first classification, sadism. They both occurred at the same time and in the same place, London in the mid-18th century. Elizabeth Brownrigg was a midwife who treated her servant girls, supplied to her from the Foundling Hospital, with such barbarity that one of them died from the beatings. She and her husband and son were tried for the offence, and Mrs. Brownrigg died on the gallows to the howling of an indignant mob. A few months later, the London crowds had an even more sensational case to gloat over, when a mother and her daughter, both called Sarah Metyard, were tried for murder of two servant girls. Like the Brownriggs, the Metyards were given to sadistic ill-treatment of their hirelings. The mother was a milliner who lived in Bruton Street, and in 1758 five girls were handed over to her from various foundling hospitals. These included a sickly child called Anne Naylor and her sister. Anne worked badly and was beaten and half-starved. She tried to run away twice, and Sarah Metyard decided to tame her by cruelty. The girl was badly beaten, then made to stand upright with her hands tied behind her back to a door handle so that she couldn't sit down. After 3 days without food, she was allowed to crawl into bed, whereupon she expired of exhaustion. The other girls were told to go and wake her up. When they said that she wouldn't move, the younger Sarah Metyard, a teenager, flung herself upon the body and beat it with a shoe. She soon realised the child was dead. For a while, the two women panicked. They decided that the best plan was to conceal the body. They locked the attic door where the child lay and told the other girls that Anne had run away again. That seemed to satisfy them, all except the younger sister, who had noticed that Anne's shoes and clothes were still in her room. During the next 2 months, she voiced her suspicions. The Metyards, who were already half insane with worry about the decomposing body behind the attic door, decided she had to die too. They duly strangled her and hid her body. After this, they set about the gruesome task of disposing of Anne's remains, chopping them up and wrapping the members in two bundles. An attempt to burn one of the hands made so much smell that they took the corpse out into the street and tossed it over a wall onto the grate of a sewer. The watchman found it there the next day, and the local coroner was called to look at the pieces. Since they were so decomposed, he gave it as his opinion that the body had been dug up from a churchyard. The pieces were buried, and no one suspected the Metyards. Presumably, they disposed of the second body more efficiently. It was never found. 4 years went by, and young Sarah Metyard ceased to be her mother's favourite. All the evidence indicates that Mrs. Metyard was a violent, foul-mouthed old woman who felt the world had treated her badly. A lodger called Mr. Rooker felt sorry for the daughter and invited her to come and be his servant. The girl accepted, in spite of her mother's objections. Within a short time, she was Mr. Rooker's mistress. Her mother was enraged. She called at Mr. Rooker's house every day and screamed abuse through the front door. He tried moving out to the western suburb of Ealing, but the old lady traced him and continued to make a nuisance of herself. One day he let her into the house, hoping to cajole her into a less hostile mood. But she flew straight at her daughter and beat her. Angry words passed, some of which puzzled Mr. Rooker. When they had got rid of the old lady, he asked Sarah what she meant about killing. Sarah told him everything. Mr. Rooker decided this was the ideal way of getting his revenge on the mother. He assumed the daughter would not be brought to trial since she was still underage. He was mistaken. The Brownrigg scandal had made the officers of the law sensitive, and both Metyards had taken part in the disposal of the body. They were tried together and executed at Tyburn in July 1768, 1 year after Elizabeth Brownrigg. It is a psychological question of great interest whether crimes like these should be labelled sadistic. The motive behind them seems to be less a desire to inflict pain than a need to inflict just punishment. Probably Mrs. Metyard, like Mrs. Brownrigg, would have been outraged if anyone had accused her of enjoying hurting Anne Naylor. The same is certainly true of America's worst case of calculated ill-treatment, the O.C. Snade affair, which involved three highly respectable sisters. The girls were Caroline, Mary, and Virginia Wardlaw, daughters of a Supreme Court Justice of South Carolina. Virginia, the clever one of the family, became head of the Montgomery Female College in 1900. Her two sisters lived nearby. Caroline was married to a Colonel Martin and had a daughter named O.C., a quiet, gentle girl. Mary separated from her husband and had two sons, John and Fletcher. One day, John ran away with a pretty student from his aunt's college. He was pursued and dragged back. 2 days later, there were screams from the Wardlaw house on the campus. John was found writhing on the ground, his clothes burning. He died shortly afterwards, and the coroner agreed that the death was suicide. But his mother benefited from an insurance policy worth $12,000. There was much local gossip about the incident, and the sisters decided to separate. Mrs. Martin went to New York with O.C. and was joined there by her husband. One day, the landlady heard groans. She burst open the front door and found Colonel Martin writhing on the floor and O.C., filthy and in rags, on a bed in the corner of the room. Colonel Martin died shortly afterwards. His death was assumed to be from natural causes, and the widow benefited from a policy for $10,000. Virginia Wardlaw had now changed her job. She was principal of a women's college at Murfreesboro in Tennessee, where the other two sisters joined her. The women seemed to be dominated by a pathological meanness. They proceeded to starve O.C. to death. A doctor who called was shocked by the filth and bareness of the house. Another doctor quickly diagnosed O.C.'s complaint as starvation and threatened to get the police. The sisters told him that it was none of his business. O.C. was now married to her cousin Fletcher. This turned out to be true, but the doctor still caused trouble, and the three sisters, who now habitually wore black, left the college hastily. With the benefit of normal food, O.C. immediately revealed that she was no invalid. Indeed, she blossomed and became pregnant. But then the three deadly sisters descended again. Fletcher was completely under his mother's thumb and allowed himself to be sent to Canada. Once more, the sisters began to starve O.C. to death. When the baby was born, they immediately handed it over to a foundling hospital, telling O.C. that it was dead. And on November the 29th, 1909, at a house in East Orange, New Jersey, the police were called in to another suicide. O.C. had drowned in her bathtub in a few inches of water. As soon as the police discovered that she had been insured for $32,000, they arrested the sisters in black. Virginia Wardlaw starved herself to death in jail. O.C.'s mother was sentenced to 7 years in prison, although the prosecution declared she was insane. The third sister was found not guilty. In jail, it soon became clear that Mrs. Martin was insane. She died in an asylum in 1913. No account of family murder would be complete without a mention of the strange case of Russell Colvin, which took place in New England in 1812. Two brothers, Stephen and Jesse Bourne, hated their brother-in-law Colvin, not only because they suspected that their father meant to leave him his farm, but because he made excessive sexual demands on their sister, Sally. Sometime later, as they were clearing a field of rocks, Colvin and the brothers began to quarrel. Colvin's son ran back to the farm in a panic. Later, his uncles told him that his father had run away up the mountain and threatened to kill him if he mentioned the quarrel. 7 years after this, in 1819, old Amos Bourne, the uncle of the brothers, had a dream in which Russell Colvin appeared to him and told him that he had been murdered and his body buried near the farmhouse, which had meanwhile been burned. Charred bones were found in a field. The brothers were arrested and confessed to the murder. They were sentenced to hang. Then, to everyone's amazement, Russell Colvin turned up again. He had gone off up the mountain. No one has ever answered the question of why the brothers made such a circumstantial confession. It remains one of the greatest psychological puzzles in the history of crime. In today's society, the phenomenon of the lethal family, the family that stays together, slays together, is not likely to occur. With the increase of social communications and the shrinking of the world, it's no longer so possible for families to hide in hills and backwoods, or in city tenements even, without their presence being known to the authorities. Once they are officially on record, their murderous activities, if indeed they plan any, are severely circumscribed. They have become part of the human family in general, and are guarded against turning on their kind. Note, 1998. In 1975, 2 years after this article was written, The Legend of Sawney Bean, by witchcraft historian Ronald Holmes, demonstrated fairly conclusively that, although it has been accepted as factual by generations of historians and literary men, including Dr. Johnson, the story of Sawney Bean belongs to folklore rather than to history.